We are extremely honored to have the incredible Dr. Kenneth Cook here today to talk about diagnosing and subtyping gastroparesis. We continue to be overwhelmed by his graciousness in doing these programs for us every other month. For those unfamiliar with the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, or AGMD, we are a nonprofit organization. We serve as an educational resource for digestive motility disorders. We also function as an important information clearinghouse for members in the medical, scientific, and treatment communities. And in addition, we provide a form of support for patients and their families suffering from GI motility disorders. My name is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci. I'm a longtime patient with pseudoobstruction, gastroparesis, achalasia, diffuse esophageal spasm, and a host of other digestive and non-digestive diseases. We also have with us today Melissa Adams Van Houten. She will be co-administrating this program. Melissa, could you introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Mary Angela. My name is Melissa Adams Van Houten, and I was diagnosed with gastroparesis about 8 years ago, actually on Valentine's Day, 2014. I currently serve as the AGMD's Public Policy and Outreach Director, and I also manage several online patient support and advocacy groups.
And I hope this Valentine's Day was a lot better than when your disease started infiltrating into your life.
Much improved, yes. Thank you.
That's progress. All good news on the whole fronts. Just a few notes. Please be sure you're in a very quiet environment. Otherwise, we can hear everything in the background. In addition, for the first part of the program, we will not be taking any questions from the audience because we have that reserved specifically for the second part. And Melissa will be in charge of the Q&A portion of the program. As many of you probably know already, Dr. Kenneth Cook has a most distinguished background. He's currently the professor of medicine in the section of gastroenterology and hepatology at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. He has a career-long interest in understanding pathophysiological mechanisms of nausea and gastroparesis. A principal investigator in the NIH-sponsored Gastroparesis Clinical Research Consortium and has written 143 peer-reviewed publications, 43 chapters in 2 books, should I add a third book coming up, and also has a huge following in our organization. Dr. Cook, thank you for being with us here today and to talk about diagnosing and subtyping gastroparesis. I think it would be great if you could start off by just giving us a definition of gastroparesis, and then you can take it away from there.
All right. Thank you very much, Mary Angela, for that introduction. And I hope everybody can hear me clearly. Gee whiz, Melissa, a sort of belated happy Valentine's Day to everybody, although your Valentine's Day 8 years ago was a bit different. So, but hope everybody had a good day, and we'll get started here. We're going to talk about why all gastroparesis is not the same. And this is really the future. This is the future, and it is now, because there are different kinds of gastroparesis, but at least for gastroenterologists interested in motility, gastroparesis basically means delayed gastric emptying in the absence of mechanical obstruction. So that tells you right there that there is one kind of gastroparesis that we sort of have to worry about initially. And that is that there's gastroparesis due to mechanical obstruction. What does that mean? What is mechanical obstruction? Well, it's either scar tissue. A scar tissue is a fibrous, you've all seen scars. You can have a scar basically from old or chronic ulcer disease And if those ulcers are right by the pylorus, the pylorus is the valve that regulates emptying. So if that valve is scarred down by chronic ulcer disease, you can get obstruction. Of course, another cause of obstruction would be cancers. Cancer of the stomach is fairly unusual. And by the way, both of these causes of mechanical blockage resulting in gastroparesis, they're not that hard to diagnose, right? I mean, you can do an endoscopy. Of course, you would see that there's a narrowing or there's a tumor. You could do an upper GI X-ray and you'd most likely find it, a CAT scan. We have many ways today to find mechanical causes. I have found a few patients who have a small bowel cancer that's right around maybe 3 or 4 inches, you know, below the pylorus. Those are very rare. So we do need to keep in mind that the gastroparesis is due to a mechanical problem. Okay, so let's say that's out of the way. The patient has had endoscopy, they've had a CAT scan. There is nothing abnormal in those areas. It looks normal. And so then we would say that that is the gastroparesis we want to talk about. That is, it's delayed emptying in the absence of mechanical obstruction. And then we like to term the problem more as a neuromuscular problem. It's a neuromuscular disorder because for some reason that stomach cannot mix and empty the food from our test meal, which is usually an egg beater's sandwich. We'll talk about that in a moment. So before you subtype gastroparesis, of course, you have to have an accurate diagnosis and you have to have the right tests. So the standard one, the past 20 years or more, is the egg beater's labeled. It's an egg beater's sandwich. There should be 2 pieces of bread, a little jam on it to make it very delicious, and then a few ounces of water. And folks should be given about 20 minutes to eat it. And then, you know, it's a 4-hour test. There's a 1-minute scan after the meal is all ingested. And then there's a 1-minute scan at 1 hour, 2 hour, 3 hour, 4 hours later. So what's supposed to happen during those 4 hours? Well, during those 4 hours, the stomach is supposed to be at work. Its work, as you remember from other talks we've had, its work is to receive the food. It is to get into a normal 3 cycle per minute, 3 per minute gastric waves. These are very coordinated contractions called peristalsis. And those waves gently mix the food we eat into tiny particles in suspension. And as that progresses, and some of the meal becomes in suspension and milled, then those little bits, you know, 2 or 3 milliliters, are emptied with each contraction. And so gastric emptying is this complex but very coordinated a set of neuromuscular contractions. By the way, during the test, the patient should be, for the actual scan, most places would have you in a standing or semi-standing position. In between scans, you should be allowed to like sit in the waiting room. So I contrast that with people I've heard, you know, eat the egg sandwich and then they are on a gurney for 4 hours. They're virtually on their back for 4 hours. That's not going to give you an accurate gastric emptying study. And I still see folks who are given, I don't know, like a stew or cereal or grits, and that's not appropriate. The best control data is from the egg beater sandwich, which I described. So you have to have the right test meal. It has to be done properly. And then you can diagnose delayed gastric emptying. And so, you know, in a healthy person, by the end of 4 hours, they should have emptied 90% of that meal. So some places will describe the test as the amount emptied, the percent emptied over time, and others the percent retained. So if at the end of 4 hours, you have 10% of the meal still in the stomach, that's okay. That would be normal. So we tend to report it as percent retained here. That's what I'm used to talking about. So that's what I'll say. So what if your result was 12% remaining after 4 hours? Well, okay, that's abnormal. You didn't make the 10%. And in fact, you may hear you have the diagnosis of gastroparesis. But, you know, this bothers us, you know, because that would be extremely mild. The test could have been off, you know, plus or minus 2 or 3%. And so when I have patients who I find this, I say, well, it is abnormal, but, you know, really, you could also think of it this way. You emptied 88%. You emptied 88% of that meal in 4 hours. Yes, it's true there was 12% remaining, but is that really gastroparesis? Is that really causing your symptoms? So sometimes you have to be careful, I think, in how test results are discussed, you know, and so 12 to 20% I consider very mild, and even is that really what's causing the symptoms? The second thought might be those patients who have 20 to 30% retained. You know, now that's getting to me a bit more impressive. And then we have those who have 30% or more it is retained. So you could subtype gastroparesis even a bit on this. I must say I rarely have folks who retain, you know, 50 or 60%. You know, nobody's stomach like totally shuts down. It's very rare in response to this test meal that there's like, you know, I mean, I can't even remember when I last had somebody who had like, you know, 100% retained. So it just doesn't happen. Your stomach's tough enough. You can get this meal emptied, but it may take a while. And that's why, you know, we end up talking a lot about diet. You know, we don't recommend you have an egg beater sandwich every day. We start talking about the diet you should shift to be easier on your stomach's ability to mix and empty. I think we're going to talk about this at some time in the next month or two. So you see, this is an aspect of emptying that we could say, wow, yeah, you had 50% retained. Let's try to figure out why that is so severe. And that's why we go on to some of my research interest and some of my publications in the last few years, I don't know, 5 or 10, it seems, have looked at another aspect of the stomach, and that is the electrical rhythm. So the gastric emptying test kind of tells you about the overall work of the stomach. And let's say you had 30% retained at 4 hours. But you know, that test does not tell you why it's delayed. And in some people, we think that the electrical rhythm is a very important reason why. So here's why the rhythm is important. And so I mentioned that after we eat, the stomach switches into what's called the postprandial time basically postprandial means, you know, after the meal. The meal is ingested. The stomach now has work to do. The contractions are to be paced at 3 contractions per minute. Well, to get those pacing waves going, they're called slow waves or pace setter potentials, you need a certain cell in your stomach wall. The cell is an interstitial cell of Cajal, C-A-J-A-L, Cajal. Cajal described these cells in like 1905. He was a Spanish pathologist. He sat over a microscope and studied brain tissue. He with like pen and ink, drew out absolutely gorgeous images of what he saw under the microscope. He's the fellow who won a Nobel Prize, actually, for coming up with the idea that one neuron talks to the next neuron, which talks to the next neuron, as opposed to the concept at the time was they all fired at once. And I guess they hoped may the better neuron win. But he said, the anatomy is telling me it's this way. And the interesting thing is, thank goodness, he began looking at the GI tract, and he found these very different neuron-like cells, and it took 50, 60 years to figure out these are the pacemaker cells. The heart has pacemaker cells. It's kind of important. The heart beats at a steady rhythm. Well, guess what? The stomach is probably even more important. Well, okay, they're equally important, but anyway, I'm a gastrocentric kind of guy. So the stomach rhythm is really crucial. And those ICCs are the cells that have the rhythm. And that rhythm then is what allows those contraction waves to move and mix the food we eat and empty it. Gee, and we now know you need 5 of those cells per high power field under the microscope. And so guess what we've learned when you don't have so many of those cells? If you don't have enough of those cells and they become depleted, it's been shown now in diabetic and idiopathic gastroparesis, you begin to lose that 3 cycle per minute rhythm. It becomes erratic. And when the good rhythm becomes erratic, what takes its place? Yeah, it's dysrhythmia. It's irregular rhythms pop up. We call them things like tachygastria and bradygastria, and there's conduction defects, and it's just like cardiology. And not only do those dysrhythmias interfere with the good mixing and emptying of the food, and if they're interfering with normal mixing and emptying, well, guess what? At the end of 4 hours of work, you have some, you know, you have some food retained. And then over the years, we've studied dysrhythmias in nausea of motion sickness, nausea of pregnancy, nausea related to eating disorders, nausea of dyspepsia, nausea of gastroparesis, and yeah, they are. There's a whole set of folks who have these dysrhythmias and gastroparesis. And with our NIH work, we're kind of writing a paper. I presented it last summer in the great city of Boston. And from our NIH studies of like 280 patients with gastroparesis, you know, 66%, almost 70% had dysrhythmias. And so that would fit with their loss of the ICCs, more dysrhythmia. You know, nobody has 0 3 cycle per minute rhythm, but you know, you get into these dysrhythmia patterns. Well, guess, so you're gonna say, well, what about the other 30%? Well, here's sort of what we've seen over the years. The other 30% had a normal 3-cycle-per-minute rhythm. They had a normal 3-cycle-per-minute rhythm. And so it turns out, even when they look at biopsies from patients, it turns out that not everybody has lost or has depleted ICCs. There is a group that if you count the ICCs, they have normal numbers. And so what's their problem? Why can't they empty? They have the normal amount of ICCs and they have a 3-cycle-per-minute rhythm. And here it's very interesting because it turns out that those patients I told you at the very beginning who had the pyloric ulcers, the chronic stenosis, I actually wrote a paper about those folks because I saw some patients with gastroparesis and they weren't getting better. And I measured their electrical rhythm and this group had a beautiful 3-cycle-per-minute rhythm. And so I said, wait a minute, that's not what the book says. And these patients, certainly the first one or two, they had not been endoscoped by me. They had maybe not been endoscoped for over a year. And when I went down and I looked at their pylorus, where the food's supposed to empty, guess what? They were stenotic. I could not get my scope through the pylorus. This was mechanical obstruction. So my thought was, okay, I get it. This person can't empty because of this, fibrous old scar tissue, but the rest of their stomach's pretty good. The rest of the stomach is trying very hard to push food through that very narrowed stenotic area. So they had a normal 3-cycle-per-minute rhythm, but they couldn't empty because of that stenosis. So now fast forward with me to today. All these patients have been endoscoped by experts. There was no stenosis. Yet we had this pattern of a good rhythm, can't empty. So you see, those are two important subtypes because if you have gastroparesis but a beautiful rhythm, then these are the patients that I believe are best treated with balloon dilation of the pylorus or Botox injection and so why balloon? Because we want to stretch that pyloric muscle. We want to stretch it and loosen it up so it doesn't restrict outflow. You could call it like an outflow problem because the pylorus is in spasm. It's not stenotic, but a spasm could cause the same kind of blockage. Just being off a little bit on the coordination. Imagine the peristaltic wave coming up to the pylorus, but it's already closed. It's just off a little bit in its neuromuscular timing. We inject Botox in these patients because Botox relaxes muscle. It relaxes the smooth muscle of the sphincter. And then for those of you who are following it, there's quite a lot of interest in endoscopically cutting that muscle. That's called GPOM. It's kind of a gastric pyloromyotomy, where it's a fancy word for cutting that muscle so it can't spasm, it can't contract. And there's tests like an EndoFlip is a very fancy special balloon that you can measure how non-distensible that muscle is. And when we see patients with this 3-per-minute rhythm and they can't empty, we find that muscle is not very distensible in almost 90%+ cases. So this is, to me, a very exciting area because we are subtyping the gastroparesis really on the basis of electrical pattern. So really that's the major, I suppose, message for the day, that we separate these two, and the folks who have the good rhythm, we tend to go now right to as pyloric treatments, whereas if there's not that good rhythm, we tend to use more drugs, and we don't have that many drugs. And some of these patients who have the dysrhythmia certainly may also have a pyloric problem. But those patients then have two problems. They have the rhythm problem in the main stomach, and they may have a pyloric problem as well. So, but this is where we need to go, in my opinion. This is where we are and where we need to go in choosing therapies for patients. Also, we recently had one of our drugs for the nausea and gastroparesis failed to make its endpoints for the FDA. It failed to be better than placebo. And I really wonder if you didn't subtype people, a certain portion of those patients would have been better off with pyloric therapy. And by our data, 25 to 30%, you know, they weren't going to respond because they needed pyloric therapy. Maybe the other group would have done better. But we've had so many failures over the years in our drugs, as you know, folks who follow this, you know, I think I should call up this company and say, we need to subtype your patients and then put them in, your drug versus placebo. But, you know, for the past couple of decades, we've gotten virtually no drugs approved for gastroparesis. And part of it is our lack of understanding of the pathophysiology of the disease. And as I described to you folks, you know, today, I think that these, what we know, the only cell line in the gastroparetic stomach that is depleted, and in some cases, maybe it's not functionally working, but it's depleted, are those ICCs. The smooth muscle looks normal. The enteric neurons have a little bit of damage to them, but nothing like the depleted ICCs. So anyway, this is where, you know, there is some progress, I think, and some insight into the pathophysiology of the disease. And I've talked about some subtyping where we are now. I think the thing I wanted to mention is this breakdown, or this kind of 3 cycle per minute pattern, is seen in diabetics. It's seen in the idiopathic patients and even in the post-surgical patients, you know. So it seems to be a very basic and recurring theme in some of the patients with gastroparesis. Then the others, as I mentioned, are this other pattern of dysrhythmia. The final thing I should mention for subtyping, it doesn't get talked about too much, is during the EGG, there's a water load test, and this is where patients are asked to drink water till they're completely full. They have 5 minutes to do so. And a healthy person would drink about, on average, 500 ml. And it's like every healthy person drinks more than 300 ml in that 5 minute period. And the healthy folks feel full. The water doesn't make them nauseated or bloated or in pain. In contrast, our patients with gastroparesis, it's like anywhere from 25 to 30% fail to even drink 240 ml. At 240 ml, they're full, they're nauseated, and you know, this aspect is another differentiator, I think, because that tells us that the stretch of the stomach is not very good. The stomach's not relaxing. And, you know, we have others with gastroparesis who will drink 800 ml in 5 minutes and say, okay, now I'm full. Well, they're also nauseated. But do you see the difference? It's just a different stomach. So I hope, my hope is with these kind of more subtle abnormalities than simple rate of emptying will help us subtype gastroparesis and get to more specific treatment ideas. Mary Angela, should I stop there? Should I take questions? What do you think?
I think that would be a great idea. So I'm going to turn the program over to Melissa. And Melissa, do what you do best.
Thank you. Dr. Cook, let me start by asking you, if you subtype gastroparesis into sort of a dysrhythmia and a pyloric subcategory, would the symptoms be different for those categories, or are they just overlapping for both categories?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so they can be extremely close, especially in terms of, you know, filling up early, that feeling of fullness, that food's not working through. And I haven't looked into this specifically, but in the patient who has that very nice 3-cycle-per-minute rhythm, I will be asking them, well, you know, do you have any discomfort over there on the right side after you eat? Any kind of cramp or discomfort? Because that antrum pyloris tends to be just to the right, to the right of midline, high, either under the ribs or just below the ribs. And so if there's a discomfort in that area, that makes me wonder, is there some spasm going on? Because I've scoped them and there is no stenosis. So the problem is, guess what else? Guess what other organ is over in that area I just described that might hurt after you eat? What organ is, what else is right over there on the right side? It's a 2-point question. Who wants to take it? See, I should have been a teacher. So here's the thing. The gallbladder is in the same spot. And so a lot of patients, 70% of my patients have already had their gallbladder removed by somebody. And in a lot of them, it didn't help. Because I think it was their pyloris and spasm, pyloris sensitivity, but sometimes people have gastroparesis and, you know, sludge or stones in their gallbladder, and you take out the gallbladder, that is, and they're really not better, or they're partially better. And so I do think perhaps with the patient with more of the pyloric presentation, that there can be a little more pain over there on the right side. Otherwise, they're the same.
That makes sense. I've also seen sort of a tendency lately. I've seen some AGA publications and some Rome Foundation publications that indicate they're trying to break gastroparesis patients in terms of treatment up into nausea predominant and pain predominant patients. Do you see any benefit in that approach?
I do. In this regard, and it's something that I've sort of talked about and written about, it's this. We have patients who have nausea and fullness and early satiety. If there's a pain component, and I often ask, you know, oh, there, a patient will tell me, yeah, there is a pain. And here's the chief question. Does the pain come first and then these other symptoms? Does the pain come first and then the other symptoms? That's key. Because my main aim here is if the patient has a pain, I need to discover the cause of the pain first. You know, let the nausea wait, let the early satiety wait, but if there's a pain syndrome, you got to find what's causing the pain, because maybe it is an ulcer, maybe it is the gallbladder, maybe it is the pancreas, and then these other symptoms like nausea, I feel full, you know, they're secondary to the problem causing the pain. Do you see what I mean? Because I often hear people say, I have pain, and I say, well, when does that pain come on? Well, you know, I vomited 3 or 4 times, and then I retch for 10 minutes, and I've got this pain here in my upper abdomen. Well, that pain came after a lot of big time nausea, vomiting. And when you examine those patients, you know, and patient can examine themselves, that they'll have tender rib margin. Because when you vomit and retch, you really contract your abdominal muscles, and they can be sore. They can be sore for quite a while. So do you see, I think if there's a pain problem, it's not like don't stop looking, don't blame it on gastroparesis. Again, if you just thought of gastroparesis, a paralyzed stomach, where is the pain coming from on a paralyzed stomach? Doesn't make any sense. But if you start thinking about subtypes, and maybe it's a pyloric issue, well, the pylorus is a sphincter and they can go into spasm. And it can hurt just like a cramp. And you say, oh, okay. So that's one reason you can get pain from gastroparesis. It's a pretty good pyloric component to it. Secondly, I think if you stretch the stomach, that's why most people learn not to overdo it, not to overeat, cut the volume back, because stretch is a cause of pain. And also, this is why we do endoscopy, to make sure the pain is not due to a mucosal problem like an ulcer or esophagitis that's pretty obvious to the eye. So pain is a big deal to me. I want to know if it came on before the symptoms or after. If it became, and then sometimes it comes on in association with the meal. And so what would that be from? And as I mentioned, it could be pylorus, could be stretch, could be another organ. Does that make sense?
Complete sense. And actually, I've never heard any doctor explain it quite like that before. I think that's an important distinction. It's never even occurred to me to think whether the pain is at the same time as eating or after or before. I think that's important to be able to tell your doctor that. That's an important tip. I would like to open up the program to all the attendees, if possible. I'll open it up to your questions. Because there are so many attendees, though, we ask that you ask one question only and try to be cognizant of the time so that everybody gets a chance. If there are no questions here, I do have written questions that I can ask, but I'd like to start out with all of you. Is there anyone who has a question for Dr. Cook?
Well, I just have a little reminder before I have everybody answer, pose questions, and that is a reminder that please be sure you're in a quiet background, because we can hear everything that's going on. So with that, I'm going to unmute everybody, and Melissa, you can take it from there.
Okay. So is there anyone who has a question for Dr. Cook?
I have a question. I actually put it in the chat.
I am unable to see the chat. I'm sorry. I know that was our intention, but I can't see the chat. If you could mention your first name and ask your question, though, that would be just great.
My name is Kristen, and my question is with regards to the gastric emptying test. Dr. Cook mentioned that the egg beaters was the best test, and I'm curious if it's possible to have gastroparesis that is triggered by specific foods. So you would do the egg test and everything is fine and normal, but that you could still actually have a problem that is food specific.
Yeah, that's a good, that's a great question. We know that this meal was designed, we tried to stay away from, for instance, fatty foods. Any food with fat in it will delay emptying. And this egg beaters is almost all carbs and a little bit of protein. And we know that if you would put, you know, fibrous, if you would eat fibrous materials, that would slow stomach down, slow emptying, because you have to take care of those fibers as well. So, you know, the test was also designed to, it's still pretty good volume. It's a good challenge if you can eat the whole thing, but it was kind of designed to be benign. And so most people with some nausea, early satiety could tolerate it. So that's why I think it's been a pretty good test. There are folks who say, I have to bring in my own gluten-free bread. That's fine. They should bring in their gluten-free bread, because that could bother the test. Some people say, I don't like eggs. I'm allergic to eggs. And, you know, egg beaters is egg albumin, but that still seems to bother folks. So I think in general, this test has stood the test of time and was designed to be as benign as possible.
Thank you for that. We have a question also from Kaylee R, and she asks, do you see eating disorder related GP a lot? And if so, can it be fixed over time?
Yes, that's a very good question, because I would say in most gastro clinics, it's pretty unusual that we get to work with these patients, but I have at least two I'm currently working with who have anorexia nervosa and well-defined gastroparesis. And it's really, really difficult situation for them to find that balance of nutrition and what volumes they can eat. They're on the gastroparesis diet. They can't eat, and then they're battling, you know, these other issues of body image and all that's wrapped up in the psychiatric diagnosis. And in our old study of bulimics that I, many years ago, where we found dysrhythmia, bulimic patients tend to empty slightly on the rapid side. And so these are really tricky, and I don't think gastros, enterologists get involved too much, you know, because I think some doctors think these are self-induced symptoms, but I do wonder how many patients with anorexia, for instance, are out there struggling with their what the psychiatric docs are trying to get them to do, and people don't know they have gastroparesis, not been looked at. I hope it has, but I think when you've got both of those diagnoses, it just makes it very hard to manage, and I think it's a long-term thing. My patient has had this combo for 5 or 6 years, and we're still struggling.
Robin B would like to know if IBS can turn into gastroparesis, or are those two completely separate disorders?
Well, that's another good question, because they each have their own definition. You know, IBS should be abdominal pain. You have a pain of someplace, and altered bowel movement. you have diarrhea one day, you have pellet-like stools the next, they go back and forth. And so they sound quite different. But I would say that they're linked in this way. I have so many patients who have gastroparesis and IBS, and they have GERD, and they have small bowel bacterial overgrowth. So I think once you start getting gastroparesis and IBS, I always check for a small bowel problem, which we diagnose as overgrowth. And if you have bacterial overgrowth, well, and you try to eat lunch, as some of that food leaves your stomach, the bacteria get to enjoy your lunch. And the bacteria begin making hydrogen. They begin to break down. They're enjoying your food and creating gases that create nausea, bloating. It may even diarrhea, some nausea, and before long, you know, there's actually a problem with the small bowel motility that's showing itself in small bowel bacterial overgrowth. And what I'm getting at is I think a lot more people have a diffuse motility problem. It's not like pseudo obstruction where major dilation occurs. You know, that doesn't occur in most people. But what I'm getting at is, yes, these two happen a lot. And if you wanted to connect the dots between the stomach and the colon, that's called the small bowel. And some people say as many as 30-40% of people with gastroparesis or IBS have SIBO. SIBO rolls off the lips, right? It's easy to say SIBO. You should probably know what that is. You know, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. There's tests for it, a breath test, and now you know. Okay, I'm having a hard time because not only are they working hard to get my GERD under control, a gastroesophageal reflux problem, my gastroparesis is an issue. I've got overgrowth and I've got IBS, maybe even a defecation problem. Wow, that's a pan motility problem. And I'm not sure we know exactly how many people out there have all of those. But to your point, yes, those two could be linked in terms of a pan motility disorder, but because they affect different organs, you know, they have different kind of presenting symptoms. But also, I must say they can overlap, right? Because if you didn't have a bowel movement for 4 days, you're already a bit bloated. Now you eat, you're more bloated. You're more maybe even nauseated or uncomfortable. And you see how confusing it gets? Are those symptoms due to my stomach, my SIBO, or my IBS?
Yes, I see that confusion.
That's why, you know, that's why I call it divide and conquer. So you have to have a specific diagnosis, you know, for all those organs that are sitting in the abdomen. There's a lot of stuff in there.
Absolutely. Michelle E. would like to know, along those lines, if there's any connection between gastroparesis and hormonal fluctuations, or if there's any sort of known genetic cause.
Yeah, genetic, we're really early on in what genes might move you towards gastroparesis. You know, but we're way, it's not familial. It might just be a different thing, maybe a half a dozen or a dozen things that line up and, you know, plus inflammation or infection set you over to be a full-fledged gastroparesis. A lot. We have many years, I'm afraid, before we're smarter about the genetics, But hormones, yeah, I always look for thyroid. I always, because, a hyper or hypothyroid actually is known to affect that stomach rhythm and can, and rhythm that's too fast is as bad as too slow. I mean, you can have tachycardia that's bad, and you can have bradycardia that's bad. So the same goes for the stomach and the thyroid. We think about cortisol for hormones, diabetes, and insulin. But I think the one that's really understudied is like women's hormones, especially younger women. You know, you do very badly at looking at endometriosis. Is that a factor? We're getting interested in endometriosis. Some women are definitely affected at different times of the periods. And we know that estrogen and progesterone have an effect on the GI smooth muscle and neurons. So really, it's a whole nother area. And I would say not a whole lot being looked at pathophysiologically there. But if there was a strong menstrual cycle effect to symptoms, when I ask about that, I do say, well, have you seen a gynecologist? Do you have endometriosis? And I think that's an area where we could do some more work.
We're also seeing a lot of questions in the chat about the testing. In other words, how do you know if the loss of cells of Cajal, or how do you know if there's pyloric stenosis? Are there particular tests that determine that, or should patients be inquiring about certain tests? How do you go about determining that?
Well, so there is this test called the electrogastrogram, which is the way that you look for the electrical rhythm. And that's a commercially available test. And I was one of the developers of that test. I will reveal disclose. So that test has been out for many years, and it's been hard to find exactly, you know, where its use is. It has taken us a long time to figure out about these ICCs. So that 3 cycle per minute rhythm that we've seen over the years tells us you have a normal amount of ICCs. I mean, it really is an indirect measure. It's like when your heart is beating at a nice P wave 60 times a minute, you say, wow, I guess those fibers in the heart, they're called Purkinje fibers. Those fibers are connected. Those fibers are following off at the right sequence. They're being paced, and everybody's happy. And you know, but the cardiologist figured this out, you know, 50 years ago. We're just figuring out now that with biopsies, because we don't biopsy the whole stomach that often. But you know, if you don't have these ICCs, then you don't have the rhythm. So that's why this 3 CPM rhythm does reflect the ICCs. And so this is why we're beginning to talk about those two subgroups. Now, there was really no way to measure the pylorus distensibility until 5 years ago. And so this EndoFLIP balloon, you have to do it during endoscopy. It takes an extra 20 minutes. It's difficult technically to do, but we're learning about this non-distensibility of the pylorus. And that's where I've put this together, you know, what we do here to show, yeah, your pylorus is poorly distensible, and we need to or Botox to see if this will help you. So to me, the electrogastrogram and then this test during this tests being done during endoscopy to actually measure the pylorus are probably the two tests that are, I think, leading us forward to subtype based on more physiology than just the rate of gastric emptying.
Do you feel like there's sort of a consensus in the GI motility community about what the proper steps are for diagnosis and treatment? Is there sort of a plan that everyone follows? We first do this and then we do this sort of thing?
No, not at all. There really isn't. I think it's kind of like start with diet, try a couple of the drugs we have, get the 4-hour gastric emptying study. It's a big problem. And then what? You know, with therapies, if you have gastroparesis, you're just getting a G-palm if you want to go that direction. Some people try balloon. Some people don't think Botox works. But, you know, in the end, treatments require more, well, the more precise you can get in defining the problem, I believe the more precise you can get with your treatment. You know, otherwise, you're just going on a hope. And we do a lot of hoping in this arena, don't we? You know, there is no standard approach to this. And the same with treatments, because we have so few treatments. There is no, not that I like algorithms, but, you know, people try everything because we don't know what to do, right? So you get Zofran here, then you don't get Zofran, then you get Phenergan, then should I give you Reglan? Do you see what I mean? No, I would say, And in the community, I'm not sure if there's a message out there, a coherent message amongst the researchers. You know, there's always argument and what is the best way forward. So a lot of what I told you here today is based on what I do.
That makes sense. And it's a difficult situation for the patient, I think, because when you get a diagnosis, you sort of think, well, they're going to have a plan in place for me. And sometimes gastroparesis can be so individualized that it makes it difficult. We really appreciate your thoughts today. I know we're running short on time, so I'm going to hand it back over to Mary Angela. But as usual, you are a wonderful presenter and a wonderful teacher. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Melissa.
And I thank you for all your questions. We have so many that are in the chat, too, that we unfortunately haven't had a chance to get to. But Dr. Cook, you have a special way of listening and understanding, teaching, and explaining things so that everybody understands. You're such an extraordinary physician and humanitarian. And the passion that you have for research, education, and helping patients is absolutely amazing. You epitomize the beacon of hope, which is the motto of our organization. And Melissa, thank you for your assistance with our program today. Melissa is such an important part of our organization, and we continue to be greatly honored to have her volunteer her time and her heart to AGMD. And to all of you, as always, I speak from my heart to tell you that you are all my incredible heroes. Your willingness to learn and share a personal part of your lives and help others who are also suffering with gastroparesis, it's extremely humbling for me, to say the least. Day and night, you're in my thoughts, heart, and in my fervent prayers. May God bless you all. Thanks again. Bye-bye.